Thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about our recent work on quantum error correction and the quantum error mitigation. This talk is based on two of our recent work. The first one is a joint work with Jing-An Lin, David Cripps, Yu Tung Poon, and Bei Zhen, and Raymond Laflamme. The other one is going to be appear on archive soon. It's a joint work with Maxwell Fitzsimmons, Yu Tung Poon, and Raymond Laflamme. Okay. So today's talk is going to be formed by six parts. The first part, I will talk about the motivation of this work. Second part, I will talk about how do we approaching error mitigation as a systemic process, and also what's the relation between error mitigation and error correction. So the third part, we will, based on our definition of error mitigation, we will talk about how to actually invert a quantum channel as a linear map. The fourth part will be motivating. So a lot of error mitigation protocols are actually assume that we have the knowledge of our quantum channel. But what if we do not? This session is distributed to talk about how, what if we don't actually know the noise so well, and how that affects our error mitigation. And the last part, I will spend a little time talking about motivate from another perspective to talk about maps beyond CPTP map. And the last part is normally the conclusion and outlook. All right, let's dive into it. Okay. So I think all the audience in PI or would agree with that the ultimate goal of quantum computing is to realize fortorand quantum computation for the problems that actually preserves the quantum advantage. The way of doing the fortorands is through quantum error correction, but everyone knows that because the error correction introduce a lot of overhead to the system, and the NISQ system we have right now does not have that much extra qubits, and it's not that precise. So recent years, to overcome, we still have to combat that error or noise, right? So recent year, there's a lot of protocols that actually propose to overcome the overhead of introduced by error correction, and also to overcome the error correction, the overhead, and also to deal with the noise. Okay. So there are so many protocols that are called error mitigation. So first question we would ask is, what actually is error mitigation? Can we give it a definition? The second question naturally to ask is, what's its relation with the error correction we have been studied for a long time? And the last question is, if we can we actually develop a theory for error mitigation? Okay. And in this talk, I will address these problems, and hopefully I will share our thoughts and results in these problems. And hopefully that will be helpful or interesting to the audiences. Okay, so the first part, I will talk about what's error mitigation and what's the relation between error mitigation and error correction. So the preliminary, I will use a few terms, mathematical terms. I think people here should be must be pretty familiar with it. By quantum channels, I mean CPTP maps. And a little less familiar term is called Hermitian preserving. But that's simple. That's just linear maps that maps Hermitian operators to other Hermitian operators. Okay. So this is a simple schematic diagram of the relation between these maps. So first of all, no matter it's completely positive trace preserving, CPTP, or positive trace preserving, or Hermitian preserving trace preserving maps, these three maps are all convex sets, and they are live within each other. This is the schematic diagram of it. Okay. The other result I'm going to talk about is a well-known result for inverting CPTP maps. So for an invertible CPTP map phi, if the input dimension is equal to the output dimension, the inverse map phi it's CPTP, if only if this channel is unitary. Otherwise, it's HPTP. Because we already see that CPTP is actually a subset of HPTP. So later in this talk, when I mentioned HPTP, I meant the non-CP part of the HPTP maps. Okay. All right. Okay. So what's the difficulty of study error mitigation protocols as a whole or as a systematic approach is there's so many of them and they make so many different assumptions and they realize different goals. So I will call the first part as the active error mitigation is the analog of the active quantum error correction. That's usually we know what's the ideal operation or quantum operation U that you want. And also we have some kind of knowledge of the noise map that maps the ideal unitary to the noise unitary, the noise operations. And we can also perform some kind of measurements on these noisy states. But there are also other different approaches. So in quantum chemistry problems, people also develop other techniques to utilize the problem structure. For example, utilize the symmetric in their problem to make the result less noisy. And there is another set of approach. It's basically trying to prevent error from happening. So the first example will be the compiling-based error mitigation protocols. What they're doing is, by rearranging the pulse sequence or the way they compose the gate, they realize the desired unitary in a fashion that it's has less crosstalk noise. So it's basically like pulse optimization. And then also you can call other protocols such as quantum, the techniques in quantum channels as error mitigation. But in this subgenre, these protocols are basically trying to just make the experiment better. So they actually make the processes less noisy. So in this talk, I will focus on the first part of the first genre of the error mitigation protocols. That's first because they have less constraints on what kind of processes actually you're doing. That's the set of unitary. It's an analog of kind of more comparable to that error correction. And there are some good reviews I provide here. There are very good reviews to take a look at those different protocols. All right, okay. So let's answer what's quantum error mitigation? Okay, so there are a lot of different approaches to try to characterize what's error mitigation and what's their disadvantage, basically. Essentially, we would agree on the error mitigation tries to the noise is actually interlayered in these like desired unitaries. This is a common agreed model on error mitigation. Essentially, that's similar to what I said. They can perform measurements, and they need a classical processing over here. Okay, so here we want to define quantum error mitigation processes as trying to approximate the effect of inverting the noise map on the different assumptions. And I will kind of explain what that means and why the approximation is important in this sense. Right. So this is a very high level picture of quantum error, error correction in general. So essentially, no matter it's a classical case or the quantum case, we all need to introduce some kind of redundancy to the system. To encode one logical bit or qubit to a larger Hilbert space. I think this is a well agreed slide. So, okay. So now let's take a look at the error mitigation or active error mitigation and the error correction. So from these two formulas, they look pretty much the same in some sense, but the differences, the recovery map R can be a CPTP map. That's the definition of error correction. But because the well-known result I talked about, if your noise channel phi E is not a unitary channel, then the E inverse cannot actually be a CPTP map. In some sense, it's not physical. Okay. So why this can happen? That's because in the quantum error correction sense, the state we care about it actually only lives in the code space. So that means we only care about the states in the code space, and everything else we don't actually care. Okay. So because the encoding to the subspace processes that enable the recovery map R to be CPTP, that means we only take a look at those encoded subspaces. And we already said that the E inverse, that map is generally not CPTP. Then that means we cannot actually dilate the processes to a unitary. And the unitary is the map that we actually can be optional, can actually implement in our quantum devices. And this non-CP-ness of the inverse map resulting to, we have to introduce some kind of classical processing to deal with the non-CP-ness. So there is no way to around it. And this gave us the consequence of that, the actually error mitigated state, it does not exist in given quantum devices. So this is the key point. The non-CP-ness of the map make us do not actually have the noise, less noisy state in your system. And so this is actually a very informative statement. Why I'm saying that is because think about when you have the quantum state in your system, if you want to extract the information out of your state, you just perform measurements to read out the information you need. Or if you want to do some kind of operation, you just apply on the system, then the system will evolve the way that you want it to. But when you do not actually have the state in the system, what you have is a classical description of the less noisy state that you want. And so sometimes then people are, because it's not actually in the system, so people will think, okay, maybe for the things I want to do, I do not want the full characterization of the state anymore. Maybe I only care about a set of observable. I only want to know the expectation value, or things like that. So the less noisy state does not exist in the system, enabled many different approaches to approximate the process, because we can say, okay, like fully characterize the state is now too much trouble. Okay. But the classical description or that part of statistical information you want from the less noisy state can be right on the paper. You can process your data and the storage in your classical computer or write down on the paper anyway. But that also tells us, in that notion of channel inverse acting on the density matrix naturally has a statistical notion in that. That means if you want a one-shot like quantum experiments, we do not know how to use the inverse map to actually invert it. It's very different from you actually have a state in the system. Yeah. Okay. Hopefully I convinced you guys. The logic flow is actually, if you do error correction, you introduce the redundancy, you actually only care about the subspace, then you can make it CP, and then you can actually perform it in the system. But if you don't, you cannot make it physical. This is a slightly different perspective, but fairly similar. In this seminal work did by Chao Bernard and his colleagues, they proved that quantum error correction is equal to one-way entanglement purification protocols. In the sense that using a one EPP, you can distillate some perfect EPR pairs. The rate that you distill the perfect EPR rate is equal to the rate of your error correction codes. So now assume that we do one EPP or error correction in the EPR pair shared by Alex and Bob. But Bob size, he experienced some kind of local noise channel. And Bob somehow has the knowledge of his noise channel. What Bob can do is, okay, I perform some local measurements on my side. And based on the noise channel information, I can invert the noise. But now what Bob has is a bunch of data storage in his classical computer. He can say, okay, this is more precisely what my local measurements would look like. But the important entanglement they want preserved in the system does not exist anymore, because after he did the measurements, the entanglement does not exist anymore. And if they share more of the noisy in EPR pairs, it's still not more like, it's still not perfect EPR pairs. Okay. So from these two pictures, hopefully I convinced you that quantum error correction can actually keep your quantum state or information alive in your system. So no matter what you want to do afterwards, like perform some measurements or do some unitary transformation, you can still do it. But the error mitigation processes or the active error mitigation processes, they can only make the data on paper less noisy or close to the ideal case. All right. If I convinced you guys that it's a reasonable approach or thoughts on error mitigation, then and we set the error mitigation processes or the active error mitigation processes is try to approximate the channel inverse, then we should study how are we actually going to invert the quantum channel. Okay. Before I talk about that, I need to talk a little bit about quantum representations. I believe a lot of the audience here are familiar with the representation. And here I want to emphasize that the channels we're going to talk today mostly has the input and output dimension they are the same. And there are different representations, and they have relations related to each other. Okay, so everyone knows what's cross operator. And my PhD advisor often joke about the cross operator is all we need. Physicists only know about cross operator. It's because it's nice representation. It's easy to see its property, and it's easy to perform the calculation. But the second representation is the Choi representation. The Choi representation is very good for seeing the properties. So if the Choi wrap is Hermitian, the matrix is Hermitian, then that means the map is Hermitian preserving. And if the partial trace of your Choi representation is identity, then your map is trace preserving. And if your matrix is positive, then your channel is completely positive. But the disadvantage about Choi representation is you don't actually know how to compose map in Choi wraps. So because the Choi representation of two map composition does not equal to the matrix multiplication between these two Choi matrices. Okay. So the other commonly used representation is the superoperator. The superoperator is the one that everyone think is only good for calculation, in the sense that the channel's action on a quantum state is equal to the channel's superoperator multiplied and vectorized the quantum state. So also the composition of channels, the superoperator equals to the two superoperator multiply with each other. So that means the matrix multiplication of representation preserve the composition. So it's very convenient. In some of the literature, the vectorization of state will be read as the double cat notation. All right. So here is a simple example. I just want to quickly show you how does choi wrap change to super operator. The transition is actually if you take the right the left like upper block and vectorize it and put it in the first column and make the right bottom block and vectorize it, put the second column and etc. Then you will get your super operator. That means choi wrap. That means super operators and the choi wrap's relation is just entry, matrix entry shuffling. But because the matrix entry shuffling, we know that choi wrap of HP map is Hermitian. But after the shuffling, you do not have anything at all. You lost your pretty mathematical structure in the choi representation after you reshuffle your entries. Okay, so now we know the choi matrix are very good at seeing the property, but they are not good for calculation. The cross operator are good for calculation, good for property, but you do not know how to invert your map in cross operator. But for the super operators, it's only good for calculation. The properties you have it's no easy way to see it except you shuffling back to the choi matrix. And we are not going to talk about too much about the stand spring representation because we are not going to talk about too much about the environment. All right, okay. So the previous works about inverting quantum channels usually restrict themselves to the CPTP inverse. That's essentially because we believe that CPTP map is the only physical map. So there is no actual need to think bigger about CPTP map. So the most famous one is the path recovery. It's optimal specific to this given quantum state. So if we only care about that given state, then this can be CPTP, designed to be CPTP. And there's other CPTP inverses proposed in some literature, but they are all considering, essentially they are utilizing the convex structure of CPTP maps and trying to find the extreme channel to maximize the property that we want. All right, we already say that quantum error mitigation does not actually need the map to be CPTP, because we are also, no matter what, we're doing some classical processes. So if we break the constraint of CPTP map, make them out of the box, how are we going to do that? Okay, so our first theorem is a Dirac consequence from the representation theory of linear maps. So that's saying if your quantum channel is invertible, if and only if the superoperator is an invertible matrix. So this is very straightforward. And also, if the channel is invertible, the inverse is unique. And the superoperator of the inverse is equal to the inverse of the superoperator. Sounds like tongue twister, but you know what I mean. Okay. All right. And we already know if the input dimension is equal to the output dimension, then only unitary maps has CPTP inverse. And actually, the inverse will also be unitary. But otherwise, it's HPTP. Okay. And we also know any HPTP map can be decomposed to the linear combination of two CPTP maps. It's linear combination. It's not convex combination. This is a cute factor to know. So some people just use that this decomposition to build error mitigation protocols because that's only like two rows of CPTP map. You can just perform two rows of experiment and do the classical processing by the end. Okay, so let's take a look at those map inverses from another perspective. So by a work by Wolf and Prez-Glacia, I hope I spelled their name correctly, in their work, they're saying, they're stating that the modulus of the non-zero part of the spectrum of your CPTP map has to be less than equal to one. And we know that if you have a square matrix linear map, then you can define the spectrum independent of what representation you choose. So as a direct consequence, we prove the first property that if your map, a CPTP map, had some non-zero eigenvalue that's strictly less than one, then when you're inverting it, your inverse map will have spectrum 1 over lambda I, and that will exactly make it larger than 1. And that's the reason why. That's also part of the reason why you can't get a CPTP map inverse if you have those spectrum. Okay. All right. So this simple proposition actually tells us a CPTP inverse cannot actually be dealt with those, spectrum that's less than one. So they actually cannot, if you can't check your quantum state, the recovery map, CPTP recovery map can not actually make your state grow bigger. What this proposition told us. And then how does the error correction work is, and also the less than one spectrum, they essentially you can think as they are coming from the classical mix of your cross operators. And so how does the quantum error correction work is they add some redundancy and you do some stabilizer measurements and you kind of reduce the classical uncertainty by knowing, okay, what kind of error has happened, and then recovery by a CPTP map. So that's why, that's another perspective why you can do CPTP map for error correction. All right, okay. So we already know that the invertible CPTP map's inverse is unique. And so there's not much room for us to do anything. And so let's consider the case that you don't have an invertible CPTP map. That means your noise is not invertible. What does that mean, you have a non-invertible noise? Because when you think about it, any CPTP map can be dialed to a unitary. And we know unitary are invertible just by the itself diagram. But when you zoom into your subsystem, it's non-invertible. What that means is, okay, there's some non-local information, not local to the system you care. And the local information, together, they will determine the dynamic of your local system. So there is some piece of non-local information actually played an irreplaceable role in this evolution. That's what the non-invertible means. Okay, so the challenge of dealing with the non-invertible case, it's basically twofold. The first thing is the non-invertible case, the generalized inverse has many different choices. We have studied them in the matrix analysis literatures. And the second thing is we're directly working with superoperator. And as what we said, superoperator are entry shuffling from Choi matrix. After the shuffling, we cannot directly see the properties from your superoperator. So it seems it's very hard to say anything in only work with superoperators. Okay. Yeah. So this is a simple example of a CPTP map. So the right hand side is the more Penrose inverse, which is the mostly common used generalized inverse in the literature. And we can see in this example that this non-invertible channel Penrose inverse is not trace preserving. By looking at the diagonal entries, they are not the partial trace of the your Choi wrap is not trace preserving anymore. Okay, so that means the most commonly used Moore Penrose inverse actually may give us some trouble. It does not preserve some of the property that we might want. Okay, so the question now is, can we find another generalized inverse or many other generalized inverse to has better property than more apparent inverse? Okay, so we propose a generalized inverse called Dazan inverse. It's studied in the math literature. So the intuition we got is from the previous Michael Wolff's work. Their result is basically saying the spectrum or the eigenvectors are actually carry something. The eigenvectors of superoperator actually carry some information about my map. I probably wanted to preserve those eigenstructures as much as I can. But the small challenge is the superoperator, since it's shuffled, it's not nice anymore. That means it can be non-normal. Cannot be does not have super spectrum decomposition. It can also be non-defective. That means it cannot even be diagonalized anymore. But it's not a very big challenge, because the next thing we can do is the Jordan decomposition. Okay. So how do we build the Dazan inverses? First, we take the Jordan decomposition of the superoperator of your noise channel. And in the Dazan inverse, we kept those Q, which are invertible matrices. And we do something on the Jordan chain in the middle. J is the Jordan chain of your noise map. And the J prime is my Dazan inverse. And in the Jordan chain, you have Jordan blocks. And the Jordan blocks look like this. And except those diagonal entrance and off diagonal entrance, they're at part of zero. And what we do is, for the invertible Jordan chain, which corresponding to the generalized eigenvalue not equal to zero, it's invertible, so we just invert it. And for the nilpotent matrices, which means the Jordan block corresponding to the eigenvalue zero, we just replace it by the all zero matrix. And this is how it looks like. The J is the Jordan chain of your map, of your noise channel. And the J prime is how do we construct the Dazan inverse. All right. Okay. So we kind of wanted to prove Dazan inverse is better than Penrose inverse. For example, we want it to be TP. But another challenge is, as I stated before, the superoperator seems are not nice to work with. How do you tell something is TP or not, or CP or not, or HP or not in a superoperator representation without shuffling back to the Choi representation? But surprisingly, we can prove the Dazan inverse of an invertible map is trace preserving. Of a trace preserving map is trace preserving. That's purely lucky. We thought that's impossible for the first time. And we are able to prove it by observing the fact that the lemma 1 and the 2 are basically saying for the eigenvectors and the generalized eigenvectors of a CPTP map, a TP map is actually mostly trace zero. So if you do the take your eigenvectors and then make them back to the eigen matrices, because there is a vectorization notion over there, and then take the trace, they're mostly trace zero. And by the construction of Dazan inverse, we are able to prove, because we kept the Qs, invertible Qs around, we are able to prove the Dazan inverse is actually trace preserving. While the Penrose, more Penrose inverse cannot be, sometimes it's not trace preserving. All right. Okay. So this is the previous example I showed you guys, that non-invertible case, the non-invertible channel. And you can see the Dazan inverse actually look a lot simpler than the more Penrose inverse. The parameters are the kind of a sign of, okay, we might did something right. And we see that the Dazan inverse is Hermitian preserving, it's trace preserving, but it cannot be completely positive. It is because in the spectrum, of your previous map, it has those eigenvectors, those eigenvalues. And then when you invert it, they become larger. They become larger than one. Then this cannot be CP anymore by the theorem. Okay. All right. So that result actually shows that as a new perspective of superoperator. So superoperator is not just a representation only good for calculation. The eigenstructure of your superoperator still carries some stuff of the information of your channel. So in fact, superoperators, that representation is the best to perform some matrix decomposition in that sense. And the directly working with superoperator or natural representation is largely unexplored territory. So essentially, no one actually was wanted to deal with it before. But for dealing with the map inversions, we have to work with them. So the new perspective we get from this superoperator can actually bridge the study of generalize the channel inverse to the classical literature of generalize the inversion series in matrix theory. Okay, so in the new paper we're going to put on archive, we actually can prove that although Moore primrose inverse itself is of a CPTP map cannot be trace preserving, but it's Hermitian preserving. We can prove that. And we also proved that the composed map of your Dyson inverse and your previous channel is Hermitian preserving, trace preserving, and it's even unital. In this paper, we provide a lot generalized inverse. One of them is called maximal rank inverse, and we can prove that maximal rank inverse is actually Hermitian preserving and trace preserving. And in this paper, we also developed some other techniques for deal with those problems. All right, okay. Now I'm going to switch my topic a little bit, but it's still related to error mitigation. Is that so? There are many protocols called error mitigation. They actually depending on the your knowledge of your noise channel, and they assume the noise channel is well known and it's perfectly known. So it's natural to ask, okay, if your noise characterization is not that accurate, for example, you calibrate your system in the morning and you do experiment at night, that the system might change. So what's the gap between your knowledge of your noise and the actual noise in your system affected your error mitigation processes? That's the problem we're trying to deal with in this session. All right, okay. So this is, after we observe the inverse map structure is pretty similar. Let me set the straight stage first. So the ideal operation you want to perform is the U1 to UN unitary operations, and it maps your input state to ideal output state. So the noisy experiment you have maps you to another output state. That's the experimental noisy output state. And after you got those like different states, then you might wanna know the expectation value of some observables. And what you want the inverse map does is it maps the experimental noisy outcome back to the input state, and we have perfect knowledge of the what kind of operation we do. So the inverse map should, if it's perfect, it should map back to the input state, then map to the ideal output. So if that's possible, if the knowledge is perfect, then we can do that. But the thing is, if we don't know the noise so well, the map that maps back your experimental noisy results to the input state will have a gap. It will not actually map you back to the input state. And the gap will carry out to the will be carried out to the expectation value of your error mitigated result in that sense. All right. So from this picture, we can prove results. We proved the two properties. The first one is related to fidelity. The second one is related to the expectation values. And the math looks pretty messy, but it's easy to understand from this map. So that's basically saying if we bound the gap of the R tilde and R, which is the map back map, if we bound the gap between the state you map and the input state you map, then you can bound the distance between the ideal. You can bound the distance between the error mitigated result, the state, and the ideal state. That's the first. That's what the first. Okay, the proposition to talk about. The other proposition is basically saying, if you want your error mitigated result lies in between the experimental result and the ideal result, which means you have an improvement by perform your error mitigation, then you do want the gap between your R prime, R tilde and R is less than R and the U dagger. So how to understand that is if we make this gap, if we make this gap between your knowledge and the input state, and this map will kind of like growing taller. And then when you have that horizontal line over here, then it will kind of lies here. And that will make your, that's basically saying after the error mitigation processes, you're actually further away from the ideal result you want. So I think that's pretty intuitive. And also what this structure tells us is, the first thing is, if you want to directly construct the map, like what I said over here, it can be even harder than classical, just simulate the ideal results, because you still you have an extra part that's composed by your ideal results and noisy results, and also the noisy inverse over here. It can be even harder if you directly do it. And the second thing it tells us is basically, if you want your error mitigation processes actually make your result better, meaning that it's more accurate than your raw experimental result, you might want to know the noise well enough or precise enough. It's better than your experimental precision. So that also means if your experiment is more accurate, you need to know the noise better. All right. Now we have talked a lot about HBTP maps and CPTP maps. I will spend a little time in this session to provide a motivation to study some map which is not CPTP. Which is not CPTP, but essentially HBTP. Okay. Consider the simple model. The simple model is composed by two part of system, system A and system B. And they only have two unitary operations. And if we know that if your beginning state, which is rho A and rho B, if rho AB equal to rho A tensor and rho B, meaning that if your beginning state is separable, then we know that the red processes over here, which is the processes that the system rho A goes through after the first unitary, the phi, which denoted as phi A1, it's CPTP. And also we know that the processes, the blue processes, which is phi A21, they are all CPTP because you have a separable beginning. But so in this sense, if your phi 1A is invertible, we can naturally define the green processes, which is from phi A prime to phi A double prime. And we can define the processes by composition of the map phi A to 1 composed by the inverse of phi A, phi A1. So the function or the purpose of putting A U1 here is we actually want to generating a non-separable state on the middle, then we do not guarantee to have a CPTP map anymore. Okay. So, and because we know the inverse of CA1, CA1 is not a CPTP, can be non-CPTP anymore. So this whole processes, which is the phi A2, can be non-CP. So that means non-CP maps can also exist in the quantum system. So those not just like CPTP map that can be studied. We might need to broaden our horizon a little bit. Okay. So a very simple example is you can just let U2 equals to U1 dagger. And then the whole process, the process is a phi A21 by equal to identity. Then you will guarantee to have a phi A2 via HPTP map. All right. So this is actually can be stated as some kind of notion of non-Markovianity. So there's a lot of different ways to define non-Markovian. And one way is called the CP divisible. And this CP divisible has been studied in some previous literatures. And not that I know anyone has actually bring the HPTP map on the stage to talk about them as a physical possible map. All right. Okay, we assume on the previous setting, we assume phi A1 is invertible, then that equation exists. But what if the phi A1, which is the first processes, are not invertible? Then that means, again, that means there's some non-local information, not like in A, that determines your evolution from a rho A prime to rho A double prime. A very simple example is the swap gate. And if you have like rho AB equals to rho A tensor rho B, which you start with an entangled state, and the rho A prime will exactly equal to rho B. And this process, if you only take a look at the subsystem A for the first step, it's not invertible. Because the second register, like the B system, exactly determined what's the evolution over here. But it's still invertible because you will get a rho A double prime back to rho A in that sense. So this is a very simple example, but you will see, okay, what's a non-invertible mean in this case. In this case, it's the information completely storaged in the system B. But there is other problems, like maybe not storage and locally to any of the subsystems. It can be storage as a global information. Okay. All right. So wait, is there any contradiction between what I said about active quantum error mitigation? As I said, HPTP maps are not physical. That's why the states are not, that's why the error mitigated state is not existing in your quantum system. But the fact is, no, there is no contradiction. That's because if you can use a non-CP HPTP map to describe the system evolution, then that means there is some non-local information, not local to your system, that actually affect the processes. And then when you are doing some recovery or operation, you still cannot use that piece of information. Assume that you do not actually have access to that piece of information. And that means those maps are physical, meaning that they exist in the system, but not optional. You cannot actually make it work. Okay. So that's why there is no contradiction with what we said before. Okay, then now the question is, if the processes can be described then larger than the CPTP map, but how does that fact would change quantum error correction, quantum error mitigation, or noise characterization, or learning at all? Because a lot of literature, we just assume only CPTP map are physical. Okay. And this, we will partly give the answer. We will give a first step answer in this following work. But still, a lot of work has to be done. A lot of assumption has to check. And there's a lot of result we need to dig out. Okay. So that's basically the end of my talk. The first part is the take-home message. The take-home message is the while QEC is doing encoding and decoding repeatedly, and it maps to the subspace that you, the code subspace that you own in care, the quantum, the active error mitigation is trying to approach the mapping first. The second thing is the active quantum error mitigation does not preserve the quantum resource that you want, no matter that's your quantum state or quantum entanglement that you want to preserve. So we had a better way and a new way to build a generalized quantum inverse than the Moore Penrose inverse. We also upper bounded the performance of the error mitigation by our knowledge of the noisy, our knowledge on the noisy map. And the last thing is, if non-CP map can be physical in some sense, how would that? It's in some notion of non-Markovian. How would that change our understanding of our process? Okay, so there is a lot of future work can be done. Okay, so we still don't know if there is a smooth like transition between the technique of quantum error mitigation and quantum error correction. There are some attempts made here try to match these two processes together, but we do not know if there is a smooth processes or not. But my understanding is the active quantum error mitigation seems hard to match with those quantum error correction directly, but those passive error mitigation, essentially making the experimental that's better, those processes definitely can be combined to the future quantum error correction technique. And we can also think about new protocols of quantum error mitigation in the sense that the quantum operation you did in the system is not actually try to make the system less noisy, but you can try to think about it to make the classical processing afterwards easy. And maybe you can make the processes kind of more efficient in the sense of classical processing. And then we still have to develop theory to systemically characterize the robustness, the computation, classical computation efficiency, and the quantum computation efficiency, and the sample cost of all these error mitigation processes. And then last question, as I already said, if your map in the system can be non-CP, how does that change your error correction and everything? Because that's such a common assumption that we make. We just assume the processes are CP. And there's a lot more can be done mathematically and physically. Okay. All right. Thank you for the attention. And since that's also serve a part of the function, I'm very happy to share my knowledge or like understanding with everyone. But this, since this is also a serve part as a function of a job talk, so I also did other works related to joint algebraic numerical range and the measurements in the quantum information. And I also did some classical neural network for quantum inverse problems. If anyone interested in any of these, you can approach me and ask me questions. Yeah.
Thanks, Mi, for the great talk. Okay, cheers. Right.
Oh, yeah, there's
a question from David. Oh, okay. Hi, David, you can unmute yourself. Hi, David, you can unmute yourself.
Oh, sorry. I can't hear very well. So I just was wondering if your work on this new inverse,
mm-hmm.
can it provide better error mitigation protocols or just upper bounds on their performance?
So if I heard you clearly, you're asking me does the inverse provide new protocols or provide a new bound? Right.
Yeah, like, is there a plan to implement these in practice, or
yeah,
has it been done?
Okay. So there is a trivial. There is an easy way to do that. So there is a way called quasi probability decomposition. That's one of the protocols, and you can, as I said, HPTP map can be decompose to the linear combination of two CPTP maps. What you can do is you decompose that Darzan inverse to two CPTP maps, and you use you dilate your CPTP map to unitary, and you design two routes of experiments to do the experiment and measure the operator that you're curious about, and do the quasi probability combination by the end, and then you will get a you will get the QPD based on the Darzan inverse. Yeah, that's one protocol you can do.
Question.
Yeah.
So in terms of practical implementation, what's the advantage for doing this kind of Darzan inverse versus the Markov inverse?
Okay, so are you mean what's the difference?
What's the advantage in terms of practical?
Oh, okay, yeah. So the one of the advantages, okay, so assume you have the, I can go back to a slide and answer your question. Yeah. Okay, so you can see that we proved the Moore Penrose inverse, although it's not TP, but the composed map is trace preserving. Yeah, so what that means is Moore Penrose inverse composed with the previous map is not that bad. It's not as bad as we want. But if you don't actually know the Moore Penrose, if you don't actually know your noise channel so well, and so the Moore Penrose inverse is not actually the Moore Penrose inverse you want, like in the actual system, then you are actually basically doing a non-TP map for your system, and that will worsen very likely to worsen the result. So that gap basically coming from the gap of your knowledge of your noise. The Darzan inverse won't. Another benefit is the Moore Penrose inverse is only invariant under the orthonormal basis transformation, but Darzan inverse is invertible under any basis transformation. So if it's in that sense, it's mathematically more stable. Yeah, and also it can depend on what kind of the channel previous channel is, the Darzan inverse might does a little better, like in the average fidelity or something. So that will be very specific to your channel. Yeah.
Okay. You can unmute yourself.
I just have a question about the part where you prove bounds when you don't know the exact information of the noise.
Yep.
So actually, I was wondering, can you directly go from the expectation value of the noisy output to? So why do you have to completely invert the noise? Because if you just want to estimate like partial information on the state, then maybe there's a more efficient way to go from the noisy case to the ideal case expectation values.
Yeah, exactly. This result only holds for those processes actually just depending on the perfect knowledge of your quantum channel. That's basically, for example, the QPD and the maybe the also the measurement measurement error mitigation. Those processes actually depending on the actual noise, knowledge on your noise. But other processes, other protocols of error mitigation can kind of ease this requirement. You're correct about that. So this result only work for those. Once we assume we perfectly know the noise and we actually use the noise information.
Thanks. So then I was wondering, do you think there's like similar way to derive bounds like you do here if you only need incomplete information on the states?
So. Are you asking me, do I have other ways to derive bounds on the expectation values? With or without the knowledge of the perfect knowledge of all the channels?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's without?
Oh, yeah. So basically, I mean, you put some constraints on the expected on observables, then maybe maybe is there a analogous approach to derive bounds, similar bounds in the other situation?
Yeah, I think if you introduce more assumption to like how do you actually do the processes, like do the error mitigation, then you will have different ways to characterize the bounds. If you, yeah. Thank you. Thank you for your question.
Any other questions? Okay, so in my understanding, the reason you can use HBTP is you were considering classical information or original state. Is it correct? So
it's more like I have to do something classically. For example, the QPD processes, which is the quasi probability decomposition. What you do is you have to classically compute the decomposition of your map, and then make it take the CPTP parts or the noisy CP noisy actions in your system, and then do different experiments. Then by the end, classically compute those expectation value together. Yeah. So yeah.
What kind of quantity gives you the error for error between the original state and the mitigated state?
Can you say that again?
What kind of quantity evaluates the difference between the original state and the mitigated state?
Oh, okay. Yeah. So basically, that's the yeah. So this is the. The delta n is the knowledge, basically, essentially, the knowledge between your like the noise you characterize and the actual noise, and that noise will transfer to the inverse you apply, and then the so the norm is two norm between these things, and there are some also other constant that's because you wanna optimize over all the state, then you kind of need to take care of some upper bound n, big N is the your noise it's the yeah the noise channel, and delta N is the over here is actually what I put it, without the square without the one on the top it still holds, but the one over here means the first order approximation of the gap between the n and the actual n.
Is it possible to relate this kind of quantity to the quantum discord, for instance?
But I don't have it in top of my mind now. Yeah. Thank you. Yep.
So this is the quantum probability decomposition will recover some information.
Yeah.
Is it an example of either of these two inverses, the Morton and Rose or the Drazen, or is it something else entirely?
Say that like the last part.
The QPD method for
yeah.
Recovering
Yeah.
Is it an example of either of these two inverses, like the Moore Penrose or
yeah.
Which one?
Well, this question is. I think you're asking which one that's better for the QPD, right?
No, that's like is the QPD a particular? Is it an example of either of one of these two, or is it more general than both of these inversion processes?
Oh, QPD is generally in the obvious QPD original process. They just assume you actually it's kind of invertible in some sense. They never actually talked about if you are not invertible, how do you do it? So like then you can think about if we actually have non-invertible noise in our system, can we use the two different generalized inverse to do different things? And that's possible. Yeah, it would result in a difference.
The noise channel there is important. Is that?
Say that again?
The noise channel there is important.
Yeah. Otherwise, the basis may not be complete basis.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, well, let's thank the speaker again.